From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. My guest in the first half hour is veteran filmmaker Nicholas Stein. He's producer of the new National Geographic Channel series, Border Wars, which premieres this Sunday. Stein will tell us about his adventures during the filming of the series, including jumping from Black Hawk helicopters in the middle of the night to chase armed drug runners. Then later in the hour, we examine the prospects for immigration reform with Mark Gray of the Iowa Center for Immigrant Leadership and Integration and State Senator Paul McKinley of Sheraton. That's all coming up. First, let's check this hour's news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. So glad you could join us over the noon hour. I'm Ben Kiefer. The National Geographic Channel series Border Wars premieres this Sunday on the National Geographic Channel. The series follows the officers and agents of U.S. Customs and Border Protection as they scour the inhospitable landscape at one of the busiest border crossings in the country. The border between the United States and Mexico runs right through the sister towns of Nogales, Arizona and Nogales, Mexico, which are separated by a security fence in the treacherous Sonoran Desert. Viewers get the inside story on how the officers fight terrorism, intercept illegal entrants from the air, on the ground, and at the ports of entry. Here's an excerpt from the series premiere, which involves a chase of human smugglers.
10 minutes into his shift, Agent Eddie Berlanga receives a call from an agent already in the field.
Hey, just, sir, what's the 20 on that loaded vehicle?
Just south of the bridge.
A pickup truck was spotted collecting 11 suspected illegal immigrants walking across the border.
One of our scope operators were the ones that were able to see him hiding in the brush, and he also saw the vehicle pull up and the individuals got into the vehicle.
But when the agent approached, the pickup truck took off. Now, a high-speed desert chase is underway.
See if we can make it to that area and see if we can intercept.
Leading the chase a few miles away is Supervisory Border Patrol Agent William Ortiz.
Well, the last place I had him, yeah, I got a dust cloud up ahead of me. I'm approaching. It's going to be moving pretty quick.
The open bed of the pickup is loaded with people, some of them children, and could flip over on the uneven dirt road.
That's an excerpt from the series premiere of Border Wars. And joining us now from the headquarters of National Geographic in Washington, D.C., the filmmaker and producer of this series for the National Geographic Channel, Nick Stein. Good afternoon, Nick.
Hello. How are you today?
Great. Great to have you with us. I previewed this premiere, this hour-long premiere episode, last evening along with my 9-year-old boy on the couch yesterday evening. Extremely compelling for both of us. A real eye-opener as to the tremendous difficulty and the dangerous nature of the work these agents and officers do every day. Was it also an eye-opener for you as you began this project?
Well, it's always an eye-opener. I mean, I actually had some experience at the border working on a show called Homeland Security USA, which was on ABC. And I was just one of 5 producers, but I worked all over the place, including Texas and up in the northern border in Detroit and a number of airports and everything else. So I had I'd gone to what I call border boot camp with that program. Unfortunately, you know, television, that show was slotted up against American Idol, so that was the end of that. So I actually never thought I would be back on the border. You never know in my business. But I have worked with National Geographic for years and years and years. And sure enough, as soon as they even heard I had got this border experience, they grabbed me for their own 4-part series, which at the time they called Border Patrol, which turned into Border Wars because it's about more than just that one unit. It's about all 3 units.
Mm-hmm.
Of Customs and Border Protection, of which Border Patrol is one. So I did have experience, but I tell you something, I had not been to Nogales. Nogales is really ground zero for a lot of what is difficult about the southern border. And there's all kinds of interesting and historical reasons for that, going back to the fact that Nogales has been a smuggling town since Prohibition. the fact that they've hardened the borders early on in the California-San Diego region and drove traffic, if you will, to Arizona, and also on the Texas side, the Rio Grande's a bit of a problem for a lot of people. So it's just a kind of a giant funnel, if you will, for narcotics and legal immigration, and you know, of course, everyone's biggest worry, which is terrorism. But it's always an eye opener. I mean, you go from, you know, really chasing the bad guys, cartel members, drug smugglers, gangbangers, a lot of really hardcore criminal types, there's no question. And then you have these heartbreaking immigration stories where people are really desperate to improve their lives, or somehow they get trapped in Mexico, even though they were when they were children, they were brought into America and they've grown up illegal in America, and then as an adult, they get either deported or they go back to Mexico and they're trapped in a strange country. So you see every kind of story you can imagine, and many of them are just run the gamut from action pieces with real bad guys to just sad stories of people caught up in this bad situation.
You were also witness in this series of filming to the largest seizure of heroin in Nogales port history. Tell us about that.
Oh, you saw that. Good. That's going to air, I think, on January 25th. That was an amazing moment. It was one of those lucky things. You know, when you do this kind of documentary, you often have to be lucky. And we were there a lot. But, you know, there's plenty of times we would show up in the morning. They said, oh, you should have been here, you know, 4 hours ago. Or, you know, there's a lot of ways you can miss a story. Well, in this particular case, we got a call early in the morning, and I sent my crew down there right away to get a story that was about methamphetamines. And it was an okay story, a little bit, and, you know, wasn't that exciting. But because we were down there, we were alerted to this other narcotic situation, which turned out to be the largest heroin seizure in the history of the Nogales port. 60 pounds of heroin found in a pickup truck. And it was really, as you saw in the piece, a real example of officer instinct going on here. I mean, they have tools, they have computers, they've got dogs, they've got density busters, they've got mirrors. But at the end of the day, officer instinct, it comes into play. These guys look at behavior of the drivers. They can literally see the carotid artery in your neck if it's pumping a little too fast.
Right.
If you're gripping the steering wheel a little too hard. You know, if it's a lone male. Here's an interesting one. You look at the keys in the ignition, right?
Mm-hmm.
Normally, your car is like mine. You have a bunch of keys on your ignition key because you've got your house key and your office key and everything else. A lot of these guys will have one key.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a rented car. It's just a car with one key. There's all kinds of tip-off these guys use.
Yeah, there was one where the pickup was too clean. Everybody coming out of New Mexico has a dirty car, and this was a clean car rolling into the station, and that was a tip-off.
Well, there's all kinds of things. You can have a dirty car, and you look underneath, and there's a clean spare tire. And you go, wait a minute, this is a dirty car. And what's in the spare tire? Dope.
I was fascinated by, as you say, by the work, as you mentioned, the work of the Border Patrol agents interviewing, and I noticed on the National Geographic Channel's website, it even has a border agent simulation that you can play, where you can put yourself in the shoes of a border agent interviewing someone crossing the border to get an idea of what might be involved there. So they are looking for tip-offs, as we see in your thing, when they inspect the underside of the car with a mirror or with an X-ray. I wonder, Nick, if there were any concerns with a series like this that reveals so much about the inside tactics of the Border Patrol, the knowledge of their high-tech instruments that might provide information to drug runners, to human traffickers, so that they can come up with countermeasures. Did the Border Patrol, they have any problems with you revealing all this inside information?
Well, that's an excellent question. And the agreement that we have with them, we have editorial control over everything we do, but there is a review process in which they can look at technical problems, accuracy problems, and above and beyond, security problems. And we will discuss and edit out things that they feel gives away too many company secrets. But the truth of the matter is, there's nothing on this TV show that the cartel guys don't already know in spades.
Mm.
Their intel is extraordinary. They run dope in people based on the shifts of the Border Patrol agents and the officers. When they change shifts, boom, they'll run. They know the shifts. They have nicknames. cartel members in Nogales have nicknames for the different officers working the port. I mean, there's very little that I could put on this TV show that they don't already know.
Were there
vetted for that sort of thing anyway.
Were there tactics or some high-tech measures that you weren't allowed to report on that were edited out?
I can't tell you.
Okay.
There were a few.
Okay.
But like the Predator situation, you know, that's a real eye-opener. People don't understand that we have Predators now working on the southern border. And it's an amazing machine. Now, they're not, these Predators or these drones or these unmanned aerial vehicles are not loaded with weapons. They're loaded with cameras. But what these cameras can see is mind-blowing. 4 miles up in the air, 4 miles away, they can see a mule train, if you will, of people carrying drugs on their back, 60, 70 pounds of marijuana. They can see how many there are. They can see exactly where they are, and they can see whether they're carrying weapons, pistols or long arms, and all of this stuff goes into officer safety and agent safety. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you know what you're coming up against, you're going to be in a lot better shape to deal with it than if you're just finding them in the dark, because the images I just described are all shot in the middle of the night, and you can see this sort of thing.
Right, and these Predator drones are similar to the ones, or perhaps exactly the same ones, except they're unarmed, that we see in action in Afghanistan, Pakistan.
Exactly, and they're relatively new to the border. I mean, but I can tell you, they are welcome at the border. These guys need all the help they can get, and they need to stay as safe as they can be. So, and the other thing is, you know, they go up there, they're pilotless, they can go fly for 15 hours, they don't get cold, they don't, you know, they don't, I mean, it's an amazing asset. And
the controllers who are sitting at consoles are also in the immediate area?
Yeah, well, they're actually in Alta Vista, Arizona, which is sort of southeast of Tucson, and they're just in these sort of big boxes, and they're nearby, but that drone can fly for a long way and can look up and down the whole Mexican border. So, and again, everything works together. The technology works together. For instance, there's sensors buried in the ground all over these known smuggling areas and routes. And you step on them, they go off, and they light up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when a sensor goes off way up in the mountains west of Nogales, often they'll wait until another sensor lights up, and then another. Now, with three sensors, you get a real sense of direction and which canyons these guys may be using, right? Now you can start to deploy. But a sensor hit can activate a Predator search, and then the Predator search can really see the people, which the sensor can't, and then they'll contact the Black Hawk, which is, you know, where we got involved because we
right.
were flying with the Black Hawk.
We want to talk about that in just a minute. We have to take a short break. Nick Stein, filmmaker, producer of the new National Geographic Channel series Border Wars, a fascinating series, premieres this Sunday, and after that moves to its regular night of Mondays at 8 p.m. We'll be back with Nick Stein to talk more also about this story of jumping from Black Hawk helicopters in the middle of the night to chase armed drug runners. He'll tell us about that experience when we return. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Back on The Exchange with filmmaker Nick Stein, producer of the new National Geographic Channel series Border Wars, which premieres this Sunday on the National Geographic Channel, of course. And Nick Stein joining us from National Geographic Channel headquarters in Washington, D.C. for the next 10 minutes. Nick, tell us about how you were involved. You were fully embedded with the three operational branches of the Customs and Border Protection. This is known as the CBP, Border Patrol, Office of Field Operations at the Ports of Entry, and the Air and Marine. Now, you have in this documentary, this series about, you detail the jumping from Black Hawk helicopters. Tell us about that experience.
Well, first of all, it was maybe one of the top three experiences of my life in terms of just pure adrenaline. These pilots and these air interdiction agents in the back of this of these Blackhawks are unbelievable. They're so skilled. They're so professional. And I felt actually pretty safe with them. But still, when you are coming in lights out and you're being dialed in, if you will, based on both seismic sensor hits and often the Predator, you pretty well know that there's some action out there. You're not going to land that thing and jump out and find nothing, because at this point, we already know there are people who have no business being in that part of the world. Nobody with a legitimate concern would be in that part of the territory at that time of night. So you get kind of ready to go. It doesn't feel completely dangerous because you're with people that you trust so much to protect you, and they really do. I mean, they really watched out for us. My cameraman had night vision cameras so we can shoot in the pitch dark. It's quite an amazing experience because it's slightly operatic. There were times when we jumped groups of migrants, 30, 40 at a time, and the helicopter would drop us down, we'd jump out, we'd rush towards where these folks were. The helicopter then would light up the whole situation with a big, huge spotlight, gazillion candle spotlight, and circle and spot the people for us so that we could rush off and the agents would get them. So you can imagine how intense that is to have this Black Hawk with the noise and the lights and the agents on the ground and people running away from us. And it's quite chaotic, and yet it all works, and pretty much they get everybody they're after, and they're very professional, and they're very, even when these guys run, even when the migrants run from them, which is not good. You should never run from an officer who tells you to stop.
Do they always run, or I mean, there's a lot of money involved, as you point out in this series. Do any of the drug runners resist or fight back?
Well, it all depends. I mean, in some cases, you're just with migrants. You're with basically human cargo. And the people who run are the coyotes, the guides. They will run because they do have a rap sheet. They are cartel members. They are members of organized crimes. So what happens is you get the group, and then, you know, the people who are missing are the guides. Or sometimes the guides are caught. And when you ask the migrants who the guide is, they won't tell you because they fear repercussions later if they all end up being deported back to Mexico, or God knows, you know, how a cartel member can get to you or your family. So it's very dicey there about who the guides are and how to identify them. Now with drug runners, it's very different. We rushed in a few times on them. They dropped their loads. We're talking 60, 70 pounds of marijuana on their back, like backpacks of burlap. They'll drop their loads and disappear into the night. Now, to be honest with you, some of the most dangerous moments come after they've run away, and here's why. You're with a Border Patrol agent, right? He sees in his night vision goggles this 10 people with backpacks coming down. You rush in, they drop their load and disappear into the darkness. Now, you went from being hidden from them, and now they're hiding from you.
It's turned. The tables have turned.
The table turned instantly, and you got $250,000, $300,000 of their property, their drugs, and you are waiting for your partner to show up so you make sure that they don't try to get their drugs back, and they're armed, and you're armed, and those are the moments that actually are, I found, more frightening. It wasn't actually rushing in that was scary. It was once we rushed in and they disappeared into the brush, you know they're looking at you.
Were there moments,
you can't see them.
Nick, were there moments when you felt your life was in danger?
Well, we got shot at once.
What were the circumstances of that?
We were laying in. We were up outside of Nogales. It was a western area near their forward operating base where they kind of camp out and do these night patrols. And we laid in on sensor activations, and we were laying in. And we'd actually gotten seven migrants, and we actually stashed them under a rock and sort of laid in for some more because it was early in the night and we weren't going to trek out 2 miles just to, you know, we just were going to get see what more traffic was coming, which we'd heard was coming. Next thing you know, there's a shot rang out. And later we all determined it was a warning shot or something. I think they just wanted us to know they were there. But it really makes your heart race. One of my favorite lines, it's not in Sunday's shows, but it's in a subsequent show, I think on the 18th of January, the officer, Agent Lopez, we're whispering. We're literally whispering because we're laying in the dark, and suddenly you hear this, and he goes, "That's not good."
The understatement of the year.
That's not good. But that's all that happened. But it was enough to get my attention.
Nick Stein, I wonder, after doing this series and your other experience with filmmaking in Homeland Security matters, have you come to any conclusions about how this country can improve its approach to the challenge of border security? Are we winning, or is it a losing battle?
Well, it's a battle you can't afford not to fight. I mean, you know, if it's all relative, meaning that the security you have there, the technology, the manpower, the science, and all of that, you have it there. You take it down, or you take it further down, and you have a larger problem, right? So I don't know if it's a completely winnable situation, but I do think it's in. Well, and the other thing is this, and your viewers, your listeners are, you know, very educated audience and will understand and have heard that Congress and the president are going to try once again to do comprehensive immigration reform. Now, that means different things to different people, but they're going to try again, right? It's going to be another battle royale in Washington. But you have to do something, and it has to be not just a security matter. It has to also be about guest worker programs and path to citizenship and people who hire these folks and everything else. It goes on and on and on and on and on. So that's the overall big picture that has to happen, and they have to keep working on it. But meanwhile, you have this intense border, almost 2,000 miles long, rugged as it can possibly be. You have one of the richest countries hard up against one of the poorest countries that's going through a spasm of narco violence. And all of that, you have a real, our third largest trading partner in the world is Mexico. So you've got legitimate commerce and commuters and agriculture and cars and trains and planes and everything is coming through. It has to flow. You can't just shut the border down. Mm-hmm. And I know enough now to know that when I hear people say things like that, these sort of simplistic things, well, just shut the border down. You know, you've heard this sort of thing. Well, it makes no sense, and it's not based in reality. So it's the kind of thing you just have to work at it every day, and you hopefully, you know, work with your Mexican partners, and it improves over time.
As a matter of fact, your comments lead right into the next half hour. You'll be leaving us, but we'll be talking about the prospects for immigration reform with a couple of people here in Iowa. So
thank you for
leading us in that direction. One last question. We have about 30 seconds left. What do you hope to leave the viewer with? What impression do you want to most get across with this series?
Well, I think it ties back in, which is like if we're going to have this conversation and if Congress is going to take this up, I would really like people to watch the show so they are talking based on some real sense of the real challenges that the men and women do on our behalf, and they don't have simplistic ideas as to the difficulties, because these men and women are doing an amazing job, and they're doing a dangerous job, and it's better that people understand that before they talk about, you know, solutions than be ignorant of it. So I'm hoping this will really help people get a three-dimensional look at the issues down there.
Nick Stein, thank you so much for joining us. Filmmaker, producer of the new National Geographic Channel series, Border Wars. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Premieres this Sunday, and will continue on Mondays, this four-part series. Coming up in just a moment, we examine the prospects for immigration reform with Mark Gray of the Iowa Center for Immigrant Leadership and Integration, as well as State Senator Paul McKinley of Sheraton. That coming up in just a moment. We'd like to include your views on immigration reform when we return here on The Exchange. This is Iowa Public Radio News. We're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow at this time, I talk with several people from the new book, Voices of Multiple Sclerosis. It's a collection of essays that offers candid, heartfelt, and inspiring testimonials by those who have been affected by the crippling disease, including Dr. Terry Walls of Iowa City, who overcame secondary progressive MS through intensive nutrition and exercise, coupled with electrical stimulation. Voices of Multiple Sclerosis tomorrow, Friday at noon, here on The Exchange. Even though immigration reform is far down on Washington's to-do list after health care reform, the Afghanistan war and job creation. It's bound to be a hot-button issue this year, though the Obama administration and the Democrats who control Congress are not expected to take up immigration reform until later this year, and possibly not till the midterm elections are over. Both sides are already rallying their grassroots in anticipation of a fight that some say could make the great immigration debate of 2007 look like a playground spat. Joining me this afternoon to discuss immigration reform are Mark Gray. Mark is the director of the University of Northern Iowa's Center on Immigration, Immigrant Leadership, and Integration. He's also the co-author of the book Postville, USA, Surviving Diversity in Small-Town America. He joins us from Iowa Public Radio Studios in Cedar Falls. Good afternoon to you, Mark.
Good afternoon, sir.
Also joining us by phone, State Senator Paul McKinley, a Republican from Sheraton, also a Republican minority leader, joining us by phone. Good afternoon, Senator.
Good afternoon. Good to be here.
Great to have you both on this show. I want to open this up this way. First of all, looking to 2010, the end of 2009 saw opponents of reform organizing dozens of anti-immigration tea parties, while the pro-reform groups coordinated thousands of strategy sessions with local activists across the country. Let me turn to you, Senator Paul McKinley. First of all, how big of an issue do you think this will be in the state in 2010?
You know, I really don't see that on the radar. The only reason I think it will, or the context with in which it would be brought up, is the great budget deficit which we've seen created in Iowa. We've got the biggest budget deficit in the state's history because of this overspending. So in that context, and also within the context that we have a very high unemployment rate, so there may be some interest in talking about extending benefits to illegal aliens or the job situation, but it would only, to my knowledge, only be within that context. The majority party has not been very interested in discussing immigration reform.
Mark Gray, let me turn to you. What do you think is in store for us in 2010 in terms of immigration reform?
Well, I agree with the senator at the state level. I think it's become largely a non-issue, not just for the reasons that the senator outlined, but also the economics are changing to the point where we're seeing tremendous declines in the influxes of illegal immigrants into the state because of the recession, because of job losses and that sort of thing. And frankly, what we're seeing across the state, the more recent influxes of immigrants and refugees are all people who are clearly in the country legally. These are refugees, for example, from Africa, from Myanmar. These are folks who come on special visa privileges from the Central Pacific and so forth. And so even though it is still a tremendous issue in a lot of the communities that I work in, it is certainly not – it doesn't feel as urgent as it used to.
So you're saying that our economic problems are lessening the pressure that politicians may feel in getting a change in immigration reform?
Well, I think what has happened with the recession and job losses and a downturn in our economy, frankly, is that there aren't as many jobs available for the folks who – may come into the country illegally to take those jobs in the first place. The same is true in the state. And there is also, you know, with a crackdown on the hiring of illegal immigrants throughout various industries and various kinds of jobs within the state, employers have been very, very cautious. And there's and I have picked up a very, very discernible move away from even trying to find those kinds of employees and then hiring newcomers who are very clearly legally eligible to work within the country.
I'd like to get your respective positions on immigration reform and then have each of you respond to the other's position, if we could, at this point. Mark Gray, let me start with you. Do you favor a path to legalization for illegal immigrants and a more open-door immigration policy than we have presently?
Well, those are two very distinct issues. The first issue has to do with what do we do with the roughly 10 to 11 million folks in the country who are here illegally. Roughly a third of them, by the way, are folks who came into the country with legal visas and to simply overstate the terms of those visas, often student visas, tourist visas, and that sort of thing. And roughly and the bulk of them, by the way, are actually not folks from Latin America. They're actually from Europe. So we have to start to make some distinctions among the people who are in the country illegally. Not everyone enters the country illegally. The first part of your question is what do we do with those roughly 10 to 11 million folks? The folks who have paid very attention and your guest in the first half of the hour made it very clear that this is a very complex issue, that there are no simple solutions. We simply can't try to locate, round up, and send back 11 million people. This simply isn't possible. So the trick is, what do you do with those folks? What kind of potential path to legalization do you provide for them? The legislation that was introduced into the United States House of Representatives on December 15th by Representative Luis Gutierrez from Illinois does make a path towards – it proposes a path towards legalization, which includes learning English and civics, background checks, keeping your nose clean for 6 years, paying a fine. And a lot of the proposals, of course, would insist that these folks go to the back of the line behind those who are already waiting to legalize their status. I work with folks throughout this, throughout the business. I work with law enforcement folks. I work with immigration advocates and everybody in between. And everybody has, you know, come to realize that there simply is no way to find all of these folks, identify them, round them up, and send them back home. The logistics alone would be absolutely staggering. And in terms of your second question, which is having to do with open border, I've never said anything about, advocating for an open border.
I said a more open door immigration policy.
Yes. Okay, thank you.
A matter right. of degrees is what
sure,
I'm talking
sure.
about.
Yeah. Yeah. And as a sovereign nation, of course, we absolutely have the right to protect our borders, and we should. And as again, as your guest from the first half hour made it very clear, you know, we have some very, very dedicated folks who do that, and I'm really familiar with some of those folks right here in the Midwest, and these are very dedicated, hardworking people that I respect. But I think, but as your guest also pointed out, you simply can't shut down the border. It is varying degrees of difficulty and recognizing, of course, that if without Mexico, our economy would go right through the floor. I was in a debate once with a guy who said, I know how to solve illegal immigration. I said, how's that? He says, you turn off or you make it illegal for people living, for Mexicans living in the United States to send money home. I said, absolutely, sure, that would shut off illegal immigration tomorrow. But the problem is the second largest part of the Mexican GNP is the money that people send home from Canada and the United States. The Mexican economy would go right through the floor, and, of course, it would drag us down with them.
Mark Gray, thank you. Let's turn now to State Senator Paul McKinley. After also in light of Mark Gray's comments, what is your position on immigration reform that may be addressed at a federal level later this year in Congress?
Well, I can't speak from a federal level, although I did testify on immigration before a congressional committee probably 3-4 years ago. I can talk about it from the standpoint of Iowa. And Iowans are very welcoming people. The very fabric of this state is made up by the Irish, the Germans, Latinos, Norwegians, the Hmong, Laotians. I employed some of these people when I was in the private sector, and they were great employees. Iowans are very, very welcoming. However, they want their the residents, the people who take advantage of the bounty of this state, to be legal. And I believe that getting control of the border is absolutely the first order of business, particularly with the wave of terrorism across the world. We must put emphasis on controlling the border. Now, what do we do with the number that are already here? It's been variously described as 10 to, as I've heard, as high as 30 million. I don't know what the number is, but the reason they're here, and we alluded to this earlier, is jobs. And Arizona, I know, had enacted some laws which really shut down the ability of illegals to obtain jobs, and they went back home. So I think it can be accomplished. It isn't rounding them up, putting them on a bus, and sending them home. I know it's very complicated, but they're here for jobs. And these are great people, a lot of them. They have great families, the folks from Mexico. But Iowans want their residents, those who, again, take advantage of the many things we have to offer, they want them to be legal, and they feel very strongly about that.
I realize you operate at a state level, Mr. McKinley, but if you had the sole power to reform immigration, what would be your solution for the, whatever, 10 to maybe 30 million immigrants in the U.S. With this questionable status?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to address the issue of what is the purpose of immigration into the United States in the first place. And I think that it should be based upon what are the country's laws, what are the country's interests, I think it needs to benefit this country and be based upon what is of benefit to the United States. That said, it used to be that we would screen immigrants much more closely to fill necessary positions within the United States. And when it got to the point where they couldn't assimilate, they would shut the numbers down. I think assimilation is one of the biggest issues that we face in an increasingly polarized society, and we must assimilate, and we must not have the numbers be overwhelming. So to me, that would be the guiding the guiding light, assimilation into the United States in this democratic republic that we have.
State Senator Paul McKinley of Sheraton with us, along with Mark Gray. We want to, in the few minutes that we have remaining, we want to invite our listeners to join our conversation. Your thoughts on immigration reform. What's your reaction to what you've been hearing this hour, this half hour? Do you oppose immigration reforms that would somehow legitimize, give a path to the estimated 10 to maybe 20 million illegal immigrants in the United States? Or do you favor a path to legalization for illegal immigrants or a more open immigration policy? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Mark Gray of the UNI Center on Immigrant Leadership and Integration, I want to ask you, what's at stake for Iowa with our immigrant population, even considering that the bad economy has, it seemed, lessened the number of immigrants coming into our workforce, into our state?
Yeah, right. Excellent question. The influx of immigrants and refugees into the state has been critical to our population growth. Indeed, if you look at the census data since 1990, over the last 20 years or so, about two-thirds of our state's total population has been due to the influx of immigrants and refugees. And, of course, that's for the state as a whole. But if you look at some individual communities, of course, immigrants have been all of the population growth. And, of course, some of these towns, we're well familiar with these by now, the Postvilles and the Storm Lakes and the Marshall Towns and the Ottumwas. And even though we certainly recognize that there have been a number of challenges associated with these influxes, we also know that those towns are relatively speaking, thriving. Their populations are growing, if not stable. The schools are thriving. The local economies are doing very well. And, again, we are certainly recognize that there is, there's some short-term pain, but over the long term there's a great deal of gain. A lot of us have become absolutely convinced that the accommodation of immigrants and refugees is critical to the state's long-term social and economic health. As you look at the demographic trends for Iowa, we're a rapidly aging state. We have a rapidly aging white population, which is, as the baby boomers like me start to retire, move out of the workforce, we need folks to move into our rural and urban communities to fill those positions that are being vacated by aging baby boomers and others. So I've been convinced that, again, even though we certainly understand that there are challenges associated in the short term, over the long term, the state's future, I believe, critically hinges on our ability to accommodate these folks.
Paul McKinley, I know you touched on this earlier in the half hour, but elaborate on this. Now, as Republican minority leader in the state Senate, do you see any bills, any new laws possibly coming our way in 2010 or beyond that will have to do with immigration?
I don't, but I would like to address the issue of the aging population and Iowa's lack of growth. We're the slowest growing state in the 20th century, and the goals of the economic development goals of the state are to grow the population, expand the wealth of Iowans, and grow and expand the economy. And unfortunately, we've had policies out of this state for the last 10 years which have been absolutely opposite to what those goals should be. We've been driving jobs out of the state, and consequently we are seeing a lot of those high-paying manufacturing jobs leave, move across state borders because of our high taxes, our overzealous regulatory regime. And I've talked with businesses all summer that say because of what's going on in Des Moines, with the talk of all of this labor legislation, it would make it impossible for us to continue to do business in this state. And the taxes, our tax burdens are horrible. We're moving those jobs out of state. We appear to become a more colonized state with entry-level jobs, which is very conducive to non-skilled labor. We absolutely must turn that around and create an atmosphere where jobs can entrepreneurs and the private sector can create jobs. So we have a lot of work ahead of us, and being a fiscally responsible state is the first thing we must do. We must cut spending. We're living well beyond our means.
Okay, Paul McKinley, you mentioned there the problems with policy that you see there. Where do you place the blame?
I place the blame on the set of policies and the mission that we've been on for the past 9 to 10 years.
Political party in mind?
I would let the listeners reflect on that themselves.
Okay. Mark Gray, let me have you react to what State Senator Paul McKinley just said. compared perhaps to other states? Are we driving jobs out of the state with policies?
Yeah, well, it's been one of the interesting ironies of my time. I've lived in Iowa now for 20 years and been a professional social scientist for more than 25. And the senator is right. What's very interesting, and it's very painful, of course, to watch so many of our pretty good-paying manufacturing jobs disappear out of the state, not only moving to other states but to other countries as well. And that's been a very painful chapter. And what's been interesting, though, and the senator's right, is that a lot of the new jobs that have come back into the state, are which had already been here and then, of course, blossomed, are exactly the kind of jobs that are going to attract a relatively low-skilled population. You got to remember that most of the jobs that attract these folks do not require English. They don't require education. They don't require any kind of job skills whatsoever. And we have a lot of rhetoric out there about the fact that these folks need to learn English. And a lot of them, of course, all of them recognize that in order to fully engage in our economy, they have to speak English. But the dirty little secret, of course, is that most of them work for employers who don't want them to speak English because then they can go off and get a better job. So it's been a very interesting and difficult transition. You know, I work in a lot in small towns that are really going through a very painful painful review of their histories and where they're coming from. And they ask themselves, you know, a very simple and I think very human question is, what have we done to deserve this? And again, as I mentioned earlier, I certainly recognize that this can be a very painful transition.
Okay, let's go to our caller in Algona. Seth is joining us. Not much time this afternoon, Seth, on our show, but what do you have to add to our conversation?
Hi, I was just calling. I know that, you know, everyone's basically established that we can't necessarily ship out illegal immigrants because of the cost associated with it. So, I mean, how do we get it so when we take the employment opportunities away from them, how do we expect them to afford to return, you know, in this case, Mexico or Central America? How do we expect them to be able to afford to return to that area on their own? I'm going to go ahead and take my question off the air. Thank you.
Seth from Algona, thank you very much for your call. Can I pass that off to you, Mark Gray, and perhaps Paul McKinley, if he has a response as well?
Senator, you want to go first?
Yeah, I would say that the same way they got here. And in fact, this is what they found in Arizona. When they shut those avenues off, they have a way of getting back. These people are resourceful. They're not stupid. They're smart. And they're resourceful, or they wouldn't have come in the first place. So if you shut the job opportunity off, they're not going to stay.
Okay, it's as simple as that, Mark Gray.
Well, I think it's a little bit more complex in terms of the fact that, you know, there are always ways for people to get an income. I agree with the senator that if we shut down the employment, the direct and formal employment of immigrants, and a lot of them will be discouraged from staying here. The dirty little secret about Iowa and indeed the United States is that a lot of these folks are provided incomes not through formal employment but through what we call the informal sector and the informal economy. These are the folks who would actually – they don't technically hire folks to work for them. They either do it through contracts, which may or may not be formal. It could be word of mouth, frankly. And it's an old trick. It's an old dodge. It's an old way to get around some of the immigration laws where if you don't actually formally hire someone and make them an employee, then you don't have to check for the documents. And this is an old dodge. So what would happen, frankly, is I think that if a lot of, let's say, formal sector employers were discouraged from hiring illegal immigrants, and we are seeing this around the state, by the way, then what happens, a lot of them will fold back into what we call the informal sector, which is, you know, they become the gardeners and the people in the contract, the roof houses, and that sort of thing. So I do agree a lot of them would head home. We've already seen a tremendous number of Mexican and other Central American immigrants head home. But over the long term, the calculus that they undergo is, if I'm better off kind of waiting out here and hoping for things to get better again so that I can continue to be to earn money here, or should I go home and sit tight and wait for things to loosen up?
Of course, within the last few days, the big national news, the security flaws discovered in the attempted Christmas Day bombing, the steps now that the Obama administration is taking to correct them. Of course, national security, border security, closely tied to the immigration. Mark Gray, is this putting a fine point on this issue in a certain way or casting it in a different way, perhaps making us more xenophobic or insular?
Yeah, it's a good question, I'm asked that question almost every day now, sometimes many times a day, and it's a very fair question. I think we have to make a distinction between the kind of immigration that is more likely than others to produce folks who have a terrorist agenda. I think, again, we have this very, very tricky, very, very fine line that we walk with the border with Mexico and Canada. That is, how do you keep the goods and the capital and the necessary labor flowing back and forth in order to keep both economies relatively healthy. But in the meantime, of course, keep out the drugs, keep out the illegal, the smuggling operations, the human trafficking operations. And as your guest again in the first half of the hour made very clear, the cartels, which access the American markets for illicit drugs and human beings and that so forth, I know darn well what they're doing. They know often more about what's going on than the folks who are supposed to protect us.
Okay. We have just a few seconds left. I want to give the final word, final 30 seconds to State Senator Paul McKinley. A few words to close our show?
Yeah. Again, I think Iowa is based upon immigrants. Immigrants are very important. Iowans are welcoming people. However, we want them to be legal. We could do a lot more than we are doing to, number one, identify who is here appropriately. We oftentimes, with a wink and a nod, look the other way and establish policies that, in fact, encourage illegal immigration. And we need to stop that, and thus far we've not been able to do that because of policy considerations.
Paul McKinley, thank you very much for taking the time to join us this hour, Republican Minority Leader of Sheraton. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark Gray of the Iowa Center at UNI, the UNI Center on Immigrant Leadership and Integration. Mark is also co-author of the new book, Postville, USA, Surviving Diversity in Small Town America. Mark, thank you very much for joining us from Cedar Falls.
Thank you, sir.